Tonight on Arena, the love stories of Ireland in a new series on TG Cahir, and Jan Carson and Michelle Gallen on the new type of Northern Irish literature. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Sgeilte the Grán Héireann explores the most iconic love stories of this country. These stories echo through time, and each one has played a major part in the formation of modern Ireland, from the passion of the pirate queen, Grace O'Malley, to Oscar Wilde's affair with Lord Alfred Douglas. Ireland's greatest loves reveals the romances of the most iconic of those who shaped our nation's history. The series begins with perhaps the most tragic love story, the love triangle between Michael Collins, Kitty Kiernan and Collins' best friend, Harry Boland. Joining me to discuss all of this, Professor Dermot Ferreter and Dr. Ciara Chambers, who take part in the first programme in the series about Collins and Kitty Kiernan. Certainly complicated, you'd have to say, Dermot. And the fact that all three of them kind of met up together at the same time. Both Harry Boland and Michael Collins met Kitty Kiernan at exactly the same time.
Well, the Kiernan sisters were well known, particularly in Longford, obviously in Granard, Longford, where the family hotel was, the Greville Arms. They were part of a very big family. Kitty had been born in 1893, and the family is interesting, I suppose, because they're doing very well as part of the kind of rising Catholic bourgeoisie in the late 19th and the early 20th century. So they have a thriving business there between the hotel and the undertakers and the grocery and the hardware and practically running everything in the town, which was a thriving market town at that time. So it's quite a social hub, the hotel, and it's a place where many Republicans and Sinn Féin activists stop off when they're on the campaign trail. And of course, Harry Boland and Michael Collins in the aftermath of the 1916 Rising are very much on that trail, very much a part of the great fad or craze of Sinn Féin in 1917 as it becomes a nationwide movement. So they frequently stop off in the Greville Arms Hotel. And there are the sisters. And it's not just Kitty who was proving to be alluring for these young gentlemen. A number of her sisters are. And obviously it becomes a love triangle, effectively. I suppose what's fantastic from the historian's point of view is that so many of the letters have survived. Yeah. They're so often dependent on fragments surviving. But here we have a very substantial collection of letters that indicate that love triangle.
Yeah, over 300 letters, I think, between 1919 and 1922, or what are looked at in particular around this romance. But Dr. Ciara Chambers, Kitty Kiernan misled Harry Boland, you say it.
I do believe so, Sean, definitely, because there's a long stage in the correspondence where Harry Boland is utterly infatuated with Kitty. And she is, of course, at this stage corresponding in a rather intimate way with Michael Collins at the same time. And it takes Harry a long time to figure out that Kitty is perhaps not as interested in him as he is in her. And there's even a point, actually, where his mother writes to Kitty congratulating her on her engagement to Harry, and she signs off, "your future mother-in-law." So this is, you know, alarm bells at this stage. So Harry is clearly under the impression that he has a very solid relationship with Kitty, and she writes to Michael that she's finding it really hard to let him down, you know, that she doesn't want to break his heart, that she's finding this difficult. But it's clearly a really complex love triangle, and of course added to that is the friendship that's shared between Michael Collins and Harry Boland.
Now, I must say, I love the Irish term that's used at one point in the programme, "Triantán Suan," for love triangle, which sounds like a much more benign and beautiful thing than the harshness of love triangle. Dermot Ferreter, I'm surprised. I thought you historians would, your minds would be on much loftier things than the romance between, or the love suan, the Triantán Suan, the love triangle between these three particular characters. Do we actually learn about the history through these very personal stories?
You certainly do. I mean, the death of Collins and the love story of Collins, it's a very public story. Their engagement is eventually announced in March 1922. And of course, it's in the midst of the fallout from the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty and the run-up to the Civil War. I mean, so like that context is there. And even, you know, during the War of Independence, the Greville Arms was targeted by Crown forces because of the family's involvement in harbouring Republicans. So that broader context of the public and political and indeed military context is there. And I mean, you mentioned the Love Triangle, but there's also Gráeg Máisteach, you know, which is another theme we learned about through poetry. And I mean, I would often say that as a historian, we have an awful lot to learn from these love stories because they give you a sense of the people behind the very public events. And you mentioned Harry Boland there. I mean, Boland and Collins may have been good friends, but they're very different characters when it came to their pursuit of love, which is interesting because it's an illustration also of their very different personalities. I mean, Boland was completely over the top. He was a tailor. He was very finely dressed. He was very dashing. And he was very extravagant in his declarations of love, you know, talking about himself and Kitty being for all time lovers. And this is not the kind of thing Collins would ever have said, you know. Boland would have turned up with flowers and all sorts of presents. Collins wouldn't have been seen dead with flowers. And he actually says in one of his letters to Kitty at one stage that he's not demonstrative. Collins says this, you know, and he hates demonstrative indicators of feeling, as he puts it. So they are very different characters. But we do get a sense of how someone like Collins, who's obviously extraordinarily busy, at one stage during the War of Independence, De Valera writes to him to say, "Michael, God did not give everyone the ordered mind he gave you," because Collins wants to be busy all the time and he's admonishing his colleagues for not being busy enough. And the interesting thing about the letters is that they're written in the midst of all this busyness for Collins. And he's away, of course, for a lot of it at the treaty negotiations, and he refers at one stage to the kind of ferment of stress and activity, because Kitty is constantly looking for more from Michael.
Right.
She wants him to be more gushing. She wants more declarations of love. And she says, "You never allow your love to run through your letters in the way that I do in my letters," you know. So she is complaining a lot.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to a little exchange. And these were daily letters in for the most part. As I think it's Karen O'Loughlin at one point, the historian, asks, "Where did Collins find the time to write a letter every day in the midst of everything else he was doing?" But here's during the time in London, a little exchange between the two, and this from Wednesday night's programme.
"Dearest Kit, I don't know how things will go now, but with God's help, we have brought peace to this land of ours, a peace which will end this old strife of ours forever."
Scríobh Kitty Arash ag Micheál.
"All will end well. Ireland knows only too well that you are her strong friend, and the people are not fools. I send you my love and a great big hug and several kisses. I love you and think you are so good and brave and wonderful."
There we go. Little exchange of letters between Kitty Kiernan and Michael Collins, as heard in the new T.G. Caherty here. Scéalta Grá na hÉireann, looking at some of the great romances of Irish history. Dermot Ferriter and Ciara Chambers speaking to me about the first of those programmes. Goes out on Wednesday evening, actually, on T.G. Caher. Ciara, you get a sense of what Dermot was talking about there, that perhaps Kitty Kiernan was looking for a little bit more. But I'm wondering how much of the actual, you know, the nitty-gritty of what was going on in those very difficult negotiations does Collins give away in the letters? Would he be far too clever? I mean, I presume the letters could have been intercepted and read very easily. Was the fine detail of negotiation kept clear of the letters, or was that just not a romantic thing to be writing to your potential wife?
Yes, he's very aware that that kind of detail cannot go into these letters. So he avoids the detail of the, you know, the protracted nature of the negotiations, for example. But his letters do, as Dermot says, give an indication of his personality. They're full of practicalities. He talks a lot about his schedule and his lack of sleep at night and attending mass to light a candle for Kitty. He has a very much a routine that appears in the letters, and you get a sense of him as a practical character, whereas Kitty is much more flirtatious and mischievous, and she congratulates Collins at one point on teaching her to be a great swearer. And then we have, as Dermot says, those extravagant declarations of love in Harry's letters that are all the more romantic, but yes, very hyperbolic in many cases as well. But the treaty negotiations, the heavy sense of what was happening at that time, the personalities that Collins was interacting with, that's absent from the letters. That's yeah. clearly not there. He does, of course, write that he hopes that there has been some sort of sense of an end to this problem and that there might be a solution in sight. But he doesn't give any of the nitty gritty or the details of the negotiations.
How much detail, Dermot Farrater, does he give to Kitty Kiernan about the elusive Lady Lavery?
Well, he has to address this full on because Kitty is very concerned about the stories that are coming out of London. And we've got to remember, Collins was hugely famous. He was a celebrity and he was much sought after. And there was a demand in London high society for Collins to be at their tables. And of course, Kitty is reading about this and she's very concerned about it. And she makes that clear to him that she wants reassurance. And he does offer her that reassurance by, of course, telling her that she shouldn't believe everything that she's reading. And of course, there are all sorts of myths that have built up about Collins as the great Lothario. You know, I'm fairly confident that Collins died a virgin. And, you know, I think a lot of that can be exaggerated. But nonetheless, there were, of course, numerous women who were very attracted to Collins. Yeah. And it suited someone like Lady Lavery to hint that their relationship, I think, was something more than it actually was. But you do have all of those stories, of course, that grow wings, particularly yeah. after the death of Collins. And in many ways, because he's cut down at that stage, he kind of becomes a blank canvas onto which you can paint whatever you want. And it suited some people to exaggerate, I think, their association with them. But there's no doubt that Kitty felt quite insecure about that. And it's interesting because she's also writing about the future. She's saying she's really looking forward to planning, as she says, a lovely house and a little nest and two comfy chairs and a fire and no worries and just you and I. She resents, of course, that so much of Collins's time is taken up by national business. And she actually says that at one stage, that, you know, I'm second best. You know, you have to give to Ireland and I get what remains.
Yeah, there might be a few politician spouses thinking precisely the same thing at this very moment in time. I wonder, though, to what extent, Ciara, you know, can we look at how, you know, obviously post the treaty, the signing of the treaty, Boland and Collins are on opposite sides of that argument. Now, there's a very interesting letter quoted at one stage where Collins is, you know, says, I met up with Harry, we had a great old chat, we talked a bit about you, and there didn't seem to be much animosity there. But when it came to talking about the treaty, there was lots of animosity. Do you think that the personal fed in any way into that, in that aspect of that, the Boland-Collins divide?
Well, it's really interesting that in January 1922, Boland writes a very curt letter to Kiernan saying, congratulations on your engagement. I wish you long life and happiness. And so just as everything is exploding in relation to the signing of the treaty and the debates that are going on in relation to that, there is this final acknowledgement that Collins and Kiernan are an item and that Boland has lost the fight for her.
Right.
And so it's clear that it's really complex and intertwined, I suppose, that personal, that political, that professional interaction.
Right.
There's so much at stake there and from all those perspectives.
Yeah, and then there is that final moment when we have final section of the programme when we hear about her subsequent marriage and how Michael Collins was definitely the third person in that marriage. Picture of him, Lavery's picture, portrait of him in the sitting room. What are the children named after Collins?
I just say, Sean, I read the death notices first thing every morning. Maybe it's the historian in me. But there was a death notice last week and it was the son of Kitty Kiernan and her husband Felix, because she married Felix Cronin in 1925 and he'd been very much one of Collins's men, and they had two sons, Felix Mary and Michael Collins Cronin, and Michael Collins Cronin died last week at the age of 91.
Well, there you go. That is an interesting little detail to hear at this point. Well, may he rest in peace, indeed. And thanks to both Dr. Ciara Chambers and Professor Dermot Farrater there for speaking to us about Scéalta the Grá and the Héireann, 6-part series. And that's only one of them we've heard about there. There are 5 others as well. Some great tales to be told. Ireland's greatest love story starts on TG Cahir this Wednesday, 13th of January at 8:30 p.m. Lots of celebrations of David Bowie over the weekend on TV and on radio. He was born born on January the 8th, 1947, died on January the 10th, 2016. Interesting to listen to Bowie on A Space Oddity. He said he wasn't really that interested in science fiction, but rather saw space and aliens as a metaphor for the division between his parents' generation and the post-war kids, of which he was, of course, one. Although he didn't see Major Tom's floating off into space as a tragedy. He saw it as something the astronaut was actually wishing for. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule. There we go, Space Oddity from David Bowie, and that to remember his birthday, in fact, and his death. We spoke with Tim Burgess of the Charlatans on Thursday night's programme about the event he was taking part in as part of the Dublin Bowie Festival. They were talking about Hunky Dory, the album, one of his listening parties. You can listen back to that on our own website. And the Dublin Bowie Festival keeps going until January the 15th. DublinBowieFestival.ie will give you full details. And joining me now, two exceptional and relatively new voices in Northern Irish literature. Jan Carson, author of The Firestarters and Postcard Stories, and Michelle Gallen, whose debut novel, Big Girl, Small Town, was shortlisted for both the Irish Book Award and the Costa First Novel Award. Jan and Michelle are both taking part in Profit Makers and Risk Takers, a showcase of writing from Northern Ireland, looking at how the new generation of writers deal with the old topics of sectarianism and the Troubles, and how they're breaking new ground. One of the tools for breaking new ground is comedy, can be seen in Michelle and Jan's work, as well as in the work of Milkman author Anna Burns and Lisa McGee, the writer of Derry Girls. Let's set the scene of that new irreverent approach to the North by joining the Derry Girls' Father Peter, played by Peter Campion, at a workshop for teenage Protestant and Catholic boys and girls. The Derry Girls, Erin, played by Saoirse Monica Jackson, Michelle, Jamie Lee O'Donnell, and you'll also hear the voice of Siobhan McSweeney as Sister Michael in the midst of all of this.
Okay, so this is just a little exercise I like to kick off with. I want you guys to give me examples of things that Catholics and Protestants have in common and things that they don't have in common. Let's start with similarities. Erin, why don't you get the ball rolling?
Okay. So we both, right, so we all, God, this is actually quite hard. God, I'm actually drawing a blank here, to be honest.
Not to worry. Someone else, a similarity, yes.
Protestants are British and Catholics are Irish.
So that's actually a difference, quite a big difference. If that's okay, we can write that down. Now, back to similarities. Yes.
Protestants are richer.
Okay, so that's another difference. And I'm not sure that's actually... I mean, is that true?
I would say so.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair enough.
Yes, great. Off you go.
Catholics really buzz off statues and we don't so much.
I do enjoy a good statue, it has to be said.
So again, what we have there is a difference.
Oh, Protestants like to march and Catholics like to walk.
Catholics watch RTE.
Protestants love cleaner.
Protestants are taller.
Catholics have more freckles.
Protestants hate ABBA.
Okay, thank you.
There you go. Cliff from Derry Girls, the writing of Lisa McGee. And joining me now, Jan Carson and Michelle Gallen. Yeah, Jan, this new showcase of yours, then, Profit Makers and Risk Takers, you won't start with Father Peter's little ruse there, I would think, of saying, let's write down differences and similarities on the blackboard.
No, and I think Northern Ireland has moved on quite a bit from that as well. Like when we talk about diversity now, it's not just across the traditional sectarian lines. There's all sorts of different kinds of diversities that we're going to be exploring on Thursday. As you know, Northern Ireland is now quite an eclectic, interesting, varied place to live.
Are you saying that the sectarianism is gone too?
Oh no, I wish it was. It's definitely still there. But, you know, as we begin to look at what Northern Ireland looks like now and what the issues are now, there are a lot of different issues on the table that maybe weren't so prevalent 20, 30 years ago.
Mind you, Michelle, I do believe you had, and I don't know if the experience was quite like that scene from Derry Girls, but you were on some of this type of exercise as a teenage girl. Was it to Denmark you went, groups of Catholics and Protestants on a boat together?
We did. We were they put a lot of Catholics and Protestants on a coach in Oma and then drove us across Northern Ireland, over the Irish Sea, the whole way through Scotland and England, and then put us on a ferry over to Denmark and left us there for 2 weeks. And yeah, it was one of those trips that was kind of, I mean, I went a couple of times, that's how great it was. but it very, very much was, when I watched Derry Girls, I really identified with that scene. I really understood where the school kids were coming from, and it really reminded me of some of the, there were actually situations that weren't as comic as that, really quite frightening ones, and ones that were hilarious. So they were just these really bizarre experiences to send a coach load of kids just off like that and hope for the best.
And yet it's funny that you mentioned, you know, some of them were as comic as all of that, and some of them were a lot more frightening than what you just had there. But Jan, I mentioned in my introduction here the idea that comedy has become one of the major ways in which the current crop of Northern Irish writers are actually addressing the very frightening aspects of the Troubles and the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've Michelle with us tonight, and her novel is a fantastic example of that and has been picked up accolades for its wonderful comedy. And writers like Wendy Erskine's wonderful Sweet Home, her collection from a few years back, it's just full of that fantastic dark humour. I think it's one of the ways that Northern Irish people are really used to kind of address difficult things. I think putting a little bit of humour in gives us space to be able to process and to maybe pause and think about what's really going on in a situation. So yeah, you're absolutely right there.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that novel, Michelle, Big Girl, Small Town, and the character of Magella. You grew up in Castledarg in County Tyrone. How divided a town was that, and how is that reflected in the novel?
Well, Castledarg was a really divided town. I mean, the first time I remember meeting a Protestant was in the back of a police car, because two policemen came into our school, and I was in primary school, okay, 10 years old, and two policemen came in and escorted me and another guy out of the classroom, put us in a police car with some Protestants we didn't know, and said that we were going to be taken to an inter-community quiz. And we were now a quiz team, a Catholic Protestant quiz team. And I just remember the experience being terrifying, because I didn't know who these people were. I didn't know who the police with their guns were. And, you know, I have social anxiety at the best of times. And then I had to go sit with this team in front of all these other school kids we didn't know in an unknown venue. And we had to act as a quiz team and answer some perfectly normal questions. It was really surreal that's the first time I was introduced to a Protestant. And I can remember we went past the graveyard, the Catholic graveyard, on the way to the quiz. And I blessed myself because, you know, there's one of the many, many places you had to bless yourself in our town. And the Protestants didn't bless themselves. And I remember sitting there going, you know, and it seems really bizarre now to think that that's how our world was structured, that was my first experience of meeting another Christian.
Yeah. What about for you then? You grew up in Ballymena, Jan Carson. That was, I suppose, was that a divided town, or would you describe it differently?
I wouldn't even call it divided so much as just our bit was very single identity. So, you know, I was at university probably before I had my first significant encounter with someone from a different background. And I guess, you know, it's something that I've explored quite a lot in my work, not just the kind of politicized Protestantism, but what it was like in rural communities and the humor around Protestantism, and sometimes the lack of humor around it as well. So, yeah, I would imagine that my experience growing up was quite different from Michelle's. And I sometimes wish we could have met each other a little bit earlier and had some of these honest conversations.
What about then the fact that, you know, you've talked about Michelle and the comedy that she uses in Big Girl, Small Town. In your own writing, and I'm thinking about, I suppose, particularly of the Firestarters here, does magic realism provide you with a similar type of, I suppose, slight move away from direct realism and from hitting things on the nose?
Well, I think every writer, and particularly contemporary writers, because the Troubles have been written about so, so much, we're all looking for a new angle to approach stories that have been told before, and I guess to tell stories that haven't been told before as well. Michelle uses humour. I use magic realism because I feel it gives me a wee bit of a safe space. I can say things as allegories and metaphors that I might be a wee bit risky or close to the bone to talk about directly. But I really respect all of the writers who are beginning to explore stories about Northern Ireland's culture that haven't been told before. You start it with a clip from Derry Girls. The story of how teenage girls in Northern Ireland experienced the Troubles hasn't been told until very recently. So there's a lot more stories that still need to be told.
However, Michelle, are you sitting there? Perhaps Jan is sitting there politely too at the moment thinking, here we go again, yet another southerner. Although I'm just south of the border in Monaghan, so give me a slight break on that one. Here we go, another southerner saying, do Northern Irish writers, do you have to write about the Troubles? Is that the big topic? Is there anything else to write about? Do you feel a kind of pressure? Do you think there's a pressure on Northern Irish writers to write about the Troubles, to address the Troubles, or is it just inevitable that you have to address them?
I'm only going to speak for myself.
Sure.
And my age group. I mean, I'm mid-40s, and my first novel is post-conflict. I mean, it's set in the period of time 10 years after the ceasefire, where we were all told, you know, you've got peace, you've got peace money, your lives should be so much better. And I was living and working in Belfast at that point, and I really just felt a strong sense of paralysis all around. And it felt like things had got better, but they hadn't. There was no great leap forward. And I felt that there was a lot of unprocessed trauma and grief. So that was one period that I was really interested in, and I really specifically wanted to write about that rather than writing about a traditional novel set in the Troubles. But my second book, which I'm just finishing up, is set the summer of the ceasefire, which was a really black summer in many ways. And, you know, so I wanted to explore that specific part of the Troubles as well. And my third novel is in my head at the minute, and it won't be set in the Troubles. It's interesting, actually. Jan and I have both contributed to an anthology that's upcoming from Blackstaff Press, and it's edited by Reggie Chamberlain King. And it's kind of got a gothic feel to it, like a sort of Northern Ireland almost horror story. So not necessarily realistic short stories, but I found my writing going into the space where it was I guess there was an atmosphere of threat or menace all around when I was growing up. And I find that coming into my writing more and more. I'm very interested in younger writers like Susanna Dickey, for example, who's written a great novel, Tennis Lessons, which came out last year. And Susanna's not writing about the Troubles because she didn't grow up in the Troubles, but she's still writing within that framework of a post-conflict society.
Actually, just before we move off, because I don't want to lose sight of your own writing in the midst of all of this, you've given us a kind of a trajectory there from Big Girl, Small Town through the second novel and into the third novel, where you're moved beyond the Troubles. But maybe get a flavour of the tone of Big Girl, Small Town. You're going to read a little section for us. What do we need to know to get the context for this?
Well, I guess, I mean, you know, The Big Girl, Small Town is, the protagonist is a 27-year-old undiagnosed autistic female, and she's working in a chip shop. Her father's disappeared. He's one of those disappeared from the Troubles. He disappeared when she was around 10. She doesn't know where he is, and nobody knows where he is. Her mum is an alcoholic. She lives at home and works in a chipper. So this is just, Magella's life is very routine-based and very much dictated by the kind of the violence and trauma that's been in her community and all around her. But it's 10 years after the ceasefire, and in this little extract, Magella's on her way down to work. Magella was startled by the beeping and blurring of car horns from a queue of cars following a Land Rover and trailer around the diamond with their hazard lights flashing. A man was tied up in the trailer, covered in cow shite, straw and flour, with his head down. Magella continued plodding down the town, listening to all the young fellas and some of the young cuddies roaring as the Land Rover lapped the diamond a few times before it headed up towards the estates. Magella got a second look at the trailer, but the fella in it was too cleistered for her to make him out properly. She knew Marty had known, so she arrived at the door of the chipper and braced herself for the buzzer as she pushed her way in. Yon Paul was behind the counter, frowning. Marty obviously wasn't in, and Jan Paul had to set up the takeaway on his own. Bochy Jan! Bochy Magella, how are you doing? Not a bother. Jan Paul flipped the counter open for Magella. What is happening, the man outside? Why is he being punished? Magella looked outside, but she couldn't figure out what Jan Paul was talking about. Who? The man who is going around the town behind Land Rover? They're going to kill him? Och, him! He's just getting a doing for getting married. A doing? Jan looked at Magella, still concerned. Aye. He's getting married, so his mates have tied him up in a trailer, covered him in crap. Now they're trailing him about the town for a laugh. Jan Paul looked out the window and frowned. The Land Rover thumped over a speed bump and the fella in the trailer fell over. For a laugh. Aye. Magella felt a bit awkward. She supposed it would look cruel to Jan Paul, so she said what she'd heard other people saying in situations like this. Sure, it's only a bit of crack. I probably should have said that Jan Paul's a Polish immigrant.
Well, I was just thinking that first, because, you know, it could be Jan Paul, as in that Paul fella, you know. But there is
no,
a word.
Exactly, yeah, Jan, this, that and the other, and Jan.
Yeah, but Jan Paul is a Polish guy living in Achibogi, isn't that the place?
He's living in Achibogi, and the role of Jan Paul really is, I mean, very much at this point, you know, we'd had peace for 10 years, and we really did have the Polish come in, and they were very much welcomed. And the book explores this as well. They were very much welcomed into parts of Northern Ireland. And really, in part, it was because they were Catholic. And there was this feeling that they were bolstering numbers of religion, which I found really interesting. You know, this idea that we would welcome people based on a religion was just so strange to me.
Again,
but Jan Paul in the book really helps Magella because he asks all these dumb questions, you know, that seem dumb to everybody in the town, obvious. But actually, Magella herself has not figured out some of the answers. So she's educated from off the back of him.
Despite my Ulster background, I do have to ask you to explain the word cleistered.
Cleistered. Oh, Jan, Ulster Scots, I would say. Cleistered is a good, almost Scottish word. Cleistered is kind of like when you take something pretty sticky and you kind of put it all over something like yourself, or the floor is usually cleistered in muck, you would say, or I was cleistered. If a woman is wearing too much makeup, you would say she's cleistered in makeup. It's a very negative word.
I didn't think it was a compliment. I got that bit. I picked that up all right. So Jan Carson, the title of the event, the series of events that you're talking to us about this evening, it's called Profit Makers and Risk Takers. Now, profit there is spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T.
Yep. It's more profits, comma, makers and risk takers.
I see. Yeah. Now I got it. There's a comma.
Yeah, it's probably my bad use of punctuation in the memo. It's more a nod to kind of the aspects of Northern Irish culture that have you know, we're kind of known for the religious element, the industry element, and the kind of, I don't know what you would say the risk takers element is, but there's definitely an element of risk taking in Northern Ireland.
Do you think there's more of a, you know, do you think you have more of a risk to take than the average Southern writer, for example, or the average British writer? Is there more at stake if you're writing in a, you know, a small society like Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I think almost it's the other way around. Sometimes people more have to take a punt on us. The risk is on the other side. Quite often what happens with Northern Irish writers is we fall between the stools. So, you know, the Irish contingent assume that the UK has us covered, and the UK assume that you know, we're part of the Irish writing community. And we can often go, you know, missing from festivals and anthologies and things. So, whereas I would argue that there's such a level of quality writers coming out of this corner of the world, it's more a loss to anybody who doesn't include us.
Well, listen, I don't want to be accused of not being balanced. Will you give us a bit of a reading too? It's a news story, actually, you're going to read for us.
Yeah, I'm going to read a tiny little excerpt from a story. They're all monologues in this collection. It's a collection called The Last Resort. They're all set on the north coast of Northern Ireland in a town called Ballycastle, in the middle of a very wet weekend in a caravan park. So this is Anna. I'm not going to tell you too much about her, except that she lives in a caravan, where she's on holidays in a caravan with her mother. Mummy gives me a right pissy look. She hates being disturbed during pointless. She has to time the dinner around it. We'd sit on the sofa eating off trays while she shouted her answers at the screen. If I sat too close, I'd get shard and mashed potato. Too far away, and I couldn't reach to feed her. Mummy doesn't eat at dinner anymore. She's had no appetite since she died. Doesn't stop her watching Pointless, though, or insisting I have my dinner while it's on. It's only 5 o'clock. Nobody wants their dinner at 5. On the continent, they're just rising from lunch. Not that I've ever been to the continent. Mummy doesn't approve of it. We always took our holidays in Ayr. She liked Ayr. It was just as bleak as Ballymena, but they had a sea you could look at through the rain. Now she's gone. There's nothing keeping me from the continent. Only she's not really gone, is she? She's still here, following me round the bungalow, nagging, dragging me to church, demanding we head down the caravan every weekend. Nothing's changed. Nothing's ever going to change. Nobody else can see Mummy, but I can. I'm just doing my head in.
That's Jan Carson reading from a news story. What did you say the new collection is going to be called? The Last Resort?
The Last Resort, and it's coming out March 21st.
March 21st. I'm sure we'll be talking to you a little bit more about it before that. I just wanted to ask both of you, though, Michelle Gallen and Jan Carson, and I'll stick with you just for the time being, Jan, about in terms of growing up as you did in Ballymena, as Michelle did in Castledurg, and going to school in the various schools that you went to. What about the literature you were reading as children and the literature that was considered to be, if you like, your canon, or the writing that you might aspire towards? What was that for you, first of all, Jan?
We did read quite a lot of Irish literature. It was very much, I went to a Protestant girls' grammar school in Ballymena, and we read a lot of things like Heaney. Not a lot of women writers, I'm afraid, and also not a lot of Protestant stories. So it's one of the things that I've tried to redress in writing, that, you know, there would be another generation of women like me who grew up seeing a little bit more of their own story in the literature they're exposed to.
And does that put a kind of responsibility on you in some way?
I don't think it's our own responsibility. I feel like this is my story, and what else would I want to tell except the story I know inside out?
What about what you were reading growing up and the sort of books and literature that was being put in front of you, Michelle?
So my mum was a big reader. I still is a big reader. So I read everything she had, and she did everything Walter Mackin ever wrote. Christy Down All the Days by Christy Murr, the childhood story of Christy Murr. I'd read Christy Brown, Christy Murr, good grief. And I'd read everything in the kids section in the local library by the time I was 10. So my mum gave me her ticket. Well, she used to take things out on her ticket. So I read all Stephen King and James Herbert. I was big into horror for some reason. And then I can remember just before I went to college, I went to Trinity College. And just before I started, somebody gave me a copy of Ripley Bogle by Robert McLean Wilson. And it was the first time I read something that was contemporary Northern Irish that was really anarchic, and it just sang to me. That really made me very excited.
I remember reading that and being very excited by it at the time as well. It was a voice.
Butcher Boy as well. Yeah, so Robert McLean Wilson and The Butcher Boy were
Pat McCabe's
another one. God, it was so good. Those were ones that were like small towns and smaller worlds, and then somebody kind of, you know, somebody coming from a small community, and then everything imploding around them. I really enjoyed that.
And you were doing a little nod or sigh of agreement, I think, particularly around Ripley Bogle there, Jan.
Yeah, no, the Robert McLean Wilson was quite a big writer for me, discovering, although I'm a tiny wee bit older or younger than Michelle, so I think I was at university whenever I first got into Robert McLean Wilson, but I love his writing.
All right, well, listen, you've given us a sense of the sort of topics that might be discussed at the symposium, so let me give people a little bit of the detail of how they can become involved. Profit makers and risk takers. Profits? Makers and risk takers. It rhymes. I get it now. Profits, makers and risk takers. A showcase of writing from Northern Ireland. It starts on Thursday the 14th. Available online from eastsidearts.net. And thanks very much to both Jan Carson and Michelle Gallen for speaking to us this evening. Lovely to speak with you both.
My Story, My Song is a musical event taking place this Sunday, January the 17th, as part of the first Fortnight Festival, where positive mental health is promoted through engagement with the arts. This particular event brings together 10 musical artists, each of whom will discuss their own mental health and how it has impacted on their craft, as well as performing a cover version of a song that has helped them through a difficult period in their life. Amongst the artists taking part are a three-piece Wyvern Lingo and Cork singer-songwriter Jack O'Rourke. Karen Crowley from Wyvern Lingo joins me now, along with Jack O'Rourke. Before we talk about the event on Sunday night, we might talk, obviously live performance has been decimated this year, but on the upside, many artists have spoken about the time that they've had now, that they've been granted, I suppose, a space in where they could write new material in a very considered type of way. Is that how it has been for you, first of all, Jack?
It has been, Sean. How are you?
Not bad.
Good. Yeah, I think when we went into lockdown, I'm not someone like Steve Earle who writes on the road. I need to be at home and in my own space, in a solitary space. So in a selfish way, I found it very cathartic and creative just to sit down and have that space to write. And I wrote an album, actually, during first lockdown. So
I like the way you just dropped that in as if it was easy, Don. I wrote an album during first lockdown.
You have to.
and Karen, sorry, Karen, I was misnaming there. Cowley, no R, my addition in there.
Thank you.
What about for you and Caoimhe and Saoirse, Caoimhe Barry and Saoirse Duan, who are the other two members of Wyvern Lingo? Is it difficult? I suppose it's different when there are three of you involved. Writing and working during lockdown must have been a more hazardous affair, if you like, or certainly a logistically more difficult.
Yeah, well, it was actually, and we weren't always in the same 5K, you know, so that was tough. And for us, it was a bit different, because we had the album written and we had most of it recorded. But what the lockdown did afford us was it kind of moved all the goalposts and pressure of release. I mean, you know, normally, if this pandemic hadn't happened, we probably would have released it already. We would have been out touring. But with all those goalposts moved, with all of that, everything had changed. It just took the pressure off massively, and I think it gave us what we needed to finish it, you know. And so we actually worked remotely for that first 6 week lockdown. We just did everything online and got better at doing it like that, you know. And we didn't see each other. It was probably the longest we'd ever gone without seeing each other. It was definitely the longest we'd ever gone.
Right.
So it was mad. But
Awake You Lie is the title of the new album.
Yes. Yes.
So explain that title.
So it's a lyric from one of the songs that hasn't been released yet. And it's that particular song is, I suppose, it's talking to a friend who is going through a tough time. And it's that image of being awake at night and feeling anxious or restless, because of your mental health or because of what's going on. So we felt like it was a good title for the album, because the album deals with an awful lot of feelings of uncertainty and anxiety. And I mean, oddly, we wrote this long before COVID. So these were all things we were living and experiencing over the last 2 years. And it was weird, because when we were doing those final touches and doing those final bits and bobs in the album, and then finally naming it, it definitely did frame it in the kind of global times that were happening.
Yeah,
that was written was actually before it.
Yeah, and it also fits in quite nicely with the whole theme of First Fortnight, in that, you know, you're referring to the difficult time that your friend was going through here. However, this Sunday's event, which is My Story, My Song, Jack, it's all about how music can help you through those tough times. And you're both, all four of you, because it'll be the three of Wyvern Lingo, not just Karen. you're accepting this. I think that the format of the event is you'll be interviewed first about, you know, difficulties and periods of time in your life that may have presented challenges to your mental health. And then you'll be performing, and you've each chosen a song that you'll cover. But just to the part where you're going to be interviewed about the challenging times of your own, in your own mental health, how difficult is it to be interviewed around that type of topic, you know, to be open and frank and honest? Jack first.
I suppose it is. But I think in my own songwriting, sure, Karen's the same. You know, some people, when they write songs, they're very literal. I tend to maybe evoke things, although I have written songs that are very revealing. I find them cathartic. Music to me, I don't know why, but music and lyrics, since I was four, they've always helped me to make sense of the world. And I'm not even aware sometimes that I'm divulging something or showing something that's very, very personal to me. Sometimes when I sit back and listen back to a song, even a few months later, I go, oh, that's what it's about. So I find it very cathartic to do that. You know, some people love to kick a football around or bake a cake. And I find when I sit down at the piano, it just completely relaxes me. You know, it helps me make sense of things.
Jack, presuming, and I probably would be with him in presuming, is it similar for you, Karen? Do songs have that kind raison d'être for you?
Absolutely. I mean, that's how, I'm sure it was the same with Jack. That's how I started writing songs when I was, you know, kind of preteen age, when you're starting to exactly try and make sense of the world. And for me and the girls, it was particularly special because we were doing that together. You know, we've known each other for so long. We started writing songs together at the same time when we were very young teenagers, and we always were just open books. You know, it was always very real, very literal. And I think since we've kind of grown a bit more with I suppose our songwriting craft and everything, we're all a little bit different. But I certainly would stray more to very, very honest emotions. I mean, you can wrap it up and sometimes it's not that obvious, but a lot of the time, I think what resonates with people the most in our experience is those more honest offerings and the kind of things that have been very much born out of a real emotion and yeah.
And I know back in the olden days when you could actually come into studio and play for me in Studio 8 and we could talk to each other and you could play live and we could be in the same space without having to worry about social distancing and all the rest of it. I have a memory of speaking to the three of you about this whole idea of to what extent does one of you come in with some very personal story which then the other two help to bring out. I'm wondering how that balance is struck between the three of you, or does it actually become a story about the three of you rather than one person's story?
That's funny because I mean, generally we're all such close friends. I mean, we can't really keep secrets from each other even if we tried, so generally if someone comes with a song, you know what it's about pretty much before they've even told you.
Yeah.
You know? But definitely it does grow into that, and certainly on this forthcoming album, this was far more of a joint effort when it comes to writing from those early stages. And some songs, you know, were written by one person and then left alone and then kind of rewritten by someone else. So it's interesting. A lot of the themes are really similar, even if they came from different members each time. So this is far more of a joint thing, and it was really fun to explore that. It was really fun to actually go in deep and have that, you know, write together like that. And it's really cathartic. I mean, I consider myself so lucky that I have colleagues and friends that I can do that with, you know. It does keep us all sane.
In fact, there's probably a case that the two of you are saying, thank God she has written that song. She's finally addressing the thing that we know she needed to address for so long. And I'm sure both of you know, it's gone from two against one in many occasions, and that different for an individual to do that, Jack, I suppose, and perhaps a lonelier furrow to plough. But just as we finish up, can you give me any idea as to where you might be going in terms of the song that or an artist that has been important to you that you might use for the cover version that you're going to give as part of the event? Jack?
Me and Karen were actually talking about songs like that where you know, they help us through dealing with anything affecting our mental health. So Karen's like me, I love Paul Simon too, and Carole King. So if we were in studio, Sean, we'd probably be at the piano, the two of us, and singing in harmony, you know. But you'll have to imagine that. I'm going to go with a Tom Waits song.
You're going to go with a Tom Waits song?
Called Take It With Me.
Right, okay.
I think, a beautiful, it's a beautiful song. It's on Mule Variations, and he's talking about, you know, at the end of the day, you know, pandemic or not, what really matters. And it's just him with a piano that's slightly out of tune.
And briefly,
on a very experimental album.
Briefly, Karen, do you know, have you guys decided yet what you're doing?
Well, I think it actually just has to be me solo, because this will be live and the three of us are all in different buildings.
Right.
But I'm terribly indecisive and I can't decide. But it could be a Paul Simon song. It could be a Carole King song. It could be a James Blake song. I'm not sure.
Well, when this is all over, please, would the two of you come in and do either Carole King or Paul Simon for me? I'll hold you to that when the time comes.
I would love that.
Jack O'Rourke and Karen Carley.
You'd have to kick us out, Sean.
Yeah, for sure. Well, there they are, Karen and Jack. And the event features 10 musical acts in total. And you can find out full details Sunday the 17th of January, 7:30 p.m. Full details on firstfortnight.ie. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RTE Radio.